You are listening to a Science Actually production.
Listen to this. Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned, a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way.
Please do.
No, I insist.
No, I'm really insisting.
No. Welcome everyone to another wonderful episode of Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist. This week, besides having the dulcet tones of Benjamin Salas, our co-host, and myself, we are joined by Kieran O'Hare from the University of Sydney. Kieran, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. This is great.
No worries.
It's exceptionally great because we attempted to do an episode on the standard model of particle physics in a previous week, and it didn't go great.
I think we crushed it. I think with Kavi's professional experience and my having no scientific degrees of any kind whatsoever, I think we got it covered, really.
Yeah, it's an easy topic to cover.
Yeah. We're just here to tell you that. And just, you know, talk about TV or something, because we already covered it.
it's called the standard model because it's simple and straightforward. So as Benjamin perceives it, and hopefully, you know, a non-negligible fraction of our listeners/viewers see it, we did a decent job having a crack at explaining some of the fundamentals of, you know, the model that we think best explains the way the universe works. But perhaps for some of our more highbrow and more educated audience, we thought that we would get Kieran here because Kieran is, at least from my perspective, an expert on this topic, far more so than I am. So, Kieran, do you want to maybe introduce yourself, let the people know your background, how did you get here, and why you love this field of research so much?
Oh, sure. I am a theoretical physicist of some variety. I work in an area which I would describe as astroparticle physics. So it's the merger of astrophysics and particle physics. It's sort of the field for people who have too much of an appetite for all the different things that go on in the universe, who try to study like literally everything at the same time. This is sort of what it sounds like. But my main motivating focus in my research is the nature of dark matter, which I think is one of the most important unsolved problems in physics. And dark matter is like literally at the interface of astrophysics and particle physics. It's a problem which arises when you try to merge those two fields. So you kind of have to know a bit about both of them if you want to have any chance of solving it. Not that I have solved it after a 10-year-long career, but I'm definitely not the only person who that described. So that's I think my main motivating thing. Some people might say dark matter is a very narrow field of research to study, but I think it's a very rich field of research to study. And it's also, I have a very clear question that I want to answer, which is, what is it? That is basically what motivates all of my research. That's essentially why I'm in Australia right now is to try to work towards answering that question.
Australia. And,
Sorry, what?
You said that's why you're in Australia, to find the answer? I mean,
Well, yeah, not that there's much dark matter lurking around in Australia specifically, but there were jobs going which for people interested in working on dark matter. So that was the more mundane reason, perhaps, why Australia. Although there are dark matter experiments in Australia specifically, but there are also dark matter experiments in many, many countries as well.
I mean, I thought Australia was cool, but that's where the dark matter is. Go get it.
I feel like Benjamin was thinking, oh, okay, so it's like under the planet, like, you know, on the it's like when you lose something, you check under the cushion seats on your sofa. It's like that's where the dark matter is hiding. It's just like
throw out a loose under change, the underside of the dark matter. Go,
yeah, that's what you know. My friends would say to me to be really annoying. You know, like, oh, have you found it yet? Oh. Well, I've got a few places you can check. I mean, under my bed, hand back my cat. You know. It's not. I mean, when we say we're trying to find dark matter, it's not like we've lost it. It's like we literally just can't see it, and we need to put on the right glasses to see it. You know?
Right. So that I guess kind of like brings me to my next question, which is like, you know, we know we're seeing all of this indirect evidence. In you know measurements that we do of you know distant galaxies and things like that, and we see that there's some missing stuff, right? There's some missing matter that doesn't interact with electromagnetic radiation and the other forces that we know of, but it still interacts gravitationally. And we kind of touched on some of these points in the previous episode. So I'm curious if you can give us your insights into what you think the best ways are, maybe what you're working on in terms of how can we actively go out and find, more stronger or directer evidence, and also how that fits in with the standard model of particle physics.
Yeah, so people come at this problem from many different perspectives. There's the sort of theory-driven approach and the experiment or observation-driven approach. I mean, the theory-driven approach is very much the sort of classic approach that was taken when the evidence for this additional form of matter seemed to be building, but all at the same time, the standard model was building and becoming a very robust theory. And the thing is, in the standard model of particle physics, it's not simply that there is no dark matter particle in there. It's like there's no dark matter particle that even fits into the standard model. The standard model is a complete puzzle that has every piece accounted for. There is no like gap in the standard model where you need to fill something. So like, It seems very puzzling, so you need to extend it in some way, and there were lots of other reasons why people wanted to extend the standard model to do other things. So it was natural to think of, okay, let's just go back to the drawing board and think mathematically and think what's the way that we would extend this puzzle in the sort of most natural way or most elegant way. And usually, what will happen with the standard model is you will predict new particles. So that's the sort of theory-driven approach, and that gave rise to a bunch of dark matter candidates. So potential particles which could exist, and by the extending the rules of how particles interact and talk to each other, you can make educated guesses about how they should talk to the other standard model particles, if they should talk to the other standard model particles at all other than through gravity. And then you can hand those to an observer or to an experimentalist and say, okay, I think all this stuff out there is probably this kind of particle, and it will be talking to the electrons in this way, or the photons in this way, or the atoms in this way, or whatever. And then you can make predictions and you can test them. And that's the sort of standard approach for looking for dark matter. And it has completely failed. So there's no way to do that. Many, many candidates. I mean, an absurd number of candidates and many, many experiments all around the world, many different observations of places where we know there's a lot of dark matter, also regions of parts of cosmic history where we know dark matter has a really important role, like the early universe. There's just been no sign that it's really anything other than a collection of mass which is just in the universe and it gravitates, and that's its role, and that's all it seems to do. That is one approach that it just has not worked yet. I mean, it's not to say it won't work. I mean, there are many instances in the history of physics, and even in particle physics, where a theory has preceded discovery. But people have sort of speculated that maybe this time it's going to have to go the other way, and it will really be just a particular experiment that will get lucky, or an observation which will just observe something in just the right way, and it will reveal something knew about dark matter, it will reveal that it is actually doing something else other than just sort of sitting there having a mass. And this is the sort of experiment-driven approach, observation-driven approach, and this is becoming more and more popular now, basically because the theorists have like exhausted most of the kind of reasonable ideas. And wow. we've been burned by having great ideas that we really liked and they're not finding them. So we're becoming more, it's a more agnostic approach. It's like you just do what you do. You make the observations you're able to make and you make them as well as you're able to make them. And you run the experiments that you're able to run and you make them really, really, really precise. And then maybe something will appear. And there are instances of this happening in the history of science as well, like the discovery of the muon, for example. This entire extra generation of particles came about just because, you know, they were looking for cosmic rays, and then all of a sudden there was a new particle that they never seen before, and this opened a whole other sector of particles that we now know exist. So, you know, each way is valid. The theorists, of course, would like to precede the discovery, and the experimentalists don't care. I mean, they just they want to run the experiments, they want to find the thing. Of course, it's nice for them if they have something motivating their experiment or to make the experiment a bit more targeted, like they don't have to run the, you know, they can fine tune it to look for a particular type of thing. But yeah, so both of the approaches sort of have to work in harmony, but unfortunately neither approach has yielded any any answers yet. So that's obviously the problem.
Do we know where dark matter is distributed from my reading? Again, no science degree. From my reading, all that dark matter does, as you said, is just something that makes gravity, and it has like some mass to it. And is it more clustered or clumped near large things of real matter, like galaxies? Is it like distributed more evenly throughout the universe, or is it distributed in some kind of random pattern of some kind, or is just more focused where we can actually see actual things?
Yeah, so it's distributed around massive objects, and actually in a sense that is sort of a backwards way of thinking about it. Dark matter is the thing which causes the massive objects to exist in the first place. So dark matter collapses into these things which we call halos, and they collapse into these structures before all of the regular matter can collapse into structures. And that's primarily because it only feels gravity. All of the gas and the plasma, atoms, electrons, and nuclei, they are sort of sloshing about in the early universe because they're coupled with photons. So the photons and these regular matter are sort of fighting against each other. But in the very early universe, dark matter doesn't feel the photons at all. So it's just getting this sort of head start on collapsing into these structures. And then it pulls all of the regular matter in. So dark matter is the thing which creates the galaxies. It's not simply that it just happens to lie around. Nice. It is the thing which creates them in the first place.
Please go on. This is great.
I mean, we do these big simulations of like this process happening with dark matter collapsing into halos, pulling in gas, which then forms stars. And, you know, it's a sort of random-ish distribution in the sense that there's dark matter halos just all across the universe. But it has very particular statistical properties driven by, you know, the primordial perturbations in the dark matter that existed from the beginning, and then also the effects of gravity, which will collapse things and create these sort of hierarchy of structure where you have many, many tiny little halos, but then lower numbers of very, very large halos, and then just a handful of like the most largest superclusters around the universe. So you have this, it's a smattering of galaxies and halos all across the universe, but there is a quite well understood statistical property for the nature of all these things. Yeah,
that's fascinating. So it's kind of like they set up a kind of a guideline for regular matter to fall into.
Yeah, so you can think of it as like the scaffolding for galaxies, or like the halos are like the incubators for galaxies. Basically, I mean, this is the reason why cosmologists believe in dark matter. I mean, you can wax lyrical about galaxy rotation curves and gravitational lensing, all these things. All these things that modified gravity people like to sort of brush under the carpet or explain away somehow with their idea. But like there's this, we don't really understand how the universe kind of got to the way it looks now without dark matter. It is the thing which creates structure, really. And if you don't have dark matter, you can still form things which resemble galaxies, but they're just not galaxies that we would understand, and they're not forming on the sort of time scale cosmologically that we would understand them. So dark matter is really crucial just for understanding the way our universe looks at basically every single scale that we look at. That.
That's awesome.
Benjamin is absolutely mind blown. I can see him just hanging on every word here.
Well, I mean, I've heard of dark matter a lot and how it's the bulk of the mass of the universe and such, but to hear it on a time scale type of thing, that's it, you know, what came first, dark matter or the regular matter egg, right? And dark matter was there to help form the universe into structures, like you said, that we recognize. That was something I didn't even understand. That was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason
why. Hence, mind blown.
Yeah. I love it. Let's do a very short ad break on a related topic, and then we will come right back. So, Benjamin, are you tired of bumping into invisible objects?
Constantly.
Can't see the forest for the dark matter? Well, fear not, because Leslie's Lensing Lenses are here to save the day. These revolutionary glasses allow you to see the unseen, the mysterious, and the downright dark. With Leslie's Lensing Lenses, you'll finally be able to see that pesky dark matter that's been messing with your whole life. Order yours today and start seeing the world in a whole new light. Or should we say, dark. Leslie's Lensing Lenses, because sometimes you need a little help seeing the dark side.
Thank you.
They're getting sillier.
They are. So right now, ChatGPT is very slowly and quietly building a profile about the kind of things you ask it. Oh, lots silly of radio things, I'm sure. And yeah. Then just Leslie's Lensy.
Yeah, it's a mix between the silly radio ads and make my code better. Why is my code not working? I'm wondering, actually, on the topic of code and ChatGPT and these sorts of tools, I know that there has been work done recently by different research groups to kind of like plug in empirical data, kind of like the final results, the observations in different fields, and then see if a model can be created that explains the results, and that these models, the hope is, kind of return to us a foundational rule about physics, about the universe that we kind of already knew, but you know, this machine is coming up with it. Is there any work like that, at least, or that you know of, that's kind of trying to solve the dark matter problem in that way?
Yeah, I've heard of people discussing these sorts of tools, but they're usually working on quite smaller scale problems than that, so sub problems within the larger problem, like trying to come up with like an AI model to generate a mathematical description of something, which is then it turns into a sort of a flexible model which could describe lots of data. So it's doing sort of some hard work for you in terms of actually getting AI to create a model of dark matter. I'm sure there are probably some AI fanatics who are sort of trying to think of a way to do that. I think it's probably too big a problem. And the thing is, but you could maybe cook up some models which could explain some particular data set, like, you know, the range of morphologies of galaxies, or like create an AI which could handle gravitational lensing and create, you know, maps of dark matter out of gravitational lensing data. Those sorts of problems are really natural for this sort of tool. But like in terms of making an entire dark matter model, I think the issue there is always going to be on the particle physics side. We're using AI a lot for data analysis, but like in terms of theory, the mathematical structure of the standard model is incredibly complex. And it's not even... there are elements of it that we can't even necessarily describe yet, like to do with the strong force, for example. We don't even really know how to simulate it just using traditional techniques, let alone try to get an AI to sort of somehow stumble its way to an answer. So yeah, there's definitely, I mean, people talk about these sorts of tools more and more. And as you know, as the generation go on, like it's typically the younger generations who are more excited about these things than the older generations. So I think it's, you know, it's a tool that exists now and it's not going away. So eventually somebody will come up with a clever way to get some insights out of it. As far as I know, I don't know if there's like some big result that that AI people have really held up as like a triumph of their work. Most of the things which people are most excited about are like just day to day things, like making making calculations faster, or like if you need to run like an entire suite of simulations of different hypothetical universes, AI can allow you to run fewer of those because it can kind of interpolate between different examples when standard interpolation between two very, very complex, like entirely different universes would be quite hard. So these sort of accelerations of problem solving is where it's seen the most success in terms of like creating. I would be very skeptical of an AI generated model of dark matter at the current time. Maybe that will change in the future.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's a lot of information to process.
I guess another way of framing it, you know, like you were saying before, Kieran, that people who work on modified gravity theories, for context, these are, you know, alternative theories to the standard theories of gravity that can explain, as you said, Kieran, certain results, right? So you can use a modified gravity theory to explain galaxy rotation curves or to explain a particular lensing effect. But to kind of get this whole complete picture and also to get these kind of more fundamental things like the structure of dark matter throughout the universe, these alternative theories kind of seem to struggle a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. There is one which is called the ether scalar tensor theory, which is able to explain the cosmological evidence for dark matter. So these are sort of the structure of the CMB and then also the later structure of you know, the sizes of galaxies across the universe, basically, which is the real major triumph of the dark matter paradigm is doing that. But that is itself an unbelievably complex theory that I would not even be able to attempt to explain. And it also introduces exotic substances into the universe, or exotic fields into the universe, which is, some people would argue, it sort of runs counter to what modified gravity, the spirit of modified gravity, which is to try and get away with introducing exotic things in the universe. But it's sort of, because of the way general relativity works, it's kind of unavoidable, really. If you're going to modified gravity, you do in some sense end up introducing new things into the universe.
Right, yeah, just increasing the complexity of the theories to try to replace the existing ones. That's fair. And Benjamin's face is saying, but this is all complex, I don't get it.
Yeah.
dark matter is incredibly simple theory, really, because it only really has one number, which is the amount of it in the universe. Like dark matter is essentially a one parameter theory, and we know the value of that parameter extremely precisely thanks to cosmology, and everything else just follows from it, just sort of existing there as a sort of gravitating substance. So I would say dark matter is like the most elegant solution to this problem, even though some people find it a little sort of unsettling and think, oh, you know, you just sort of missed something. But it really does explain a lot with a single number.
I can see the cogs turning.
Well, yeah. Well, my cogs turn slower than your cogs.
How is this tying in, Benjamin, to our previous episode when we discussed the standard model? I feel like you had a lot of questions at the end of that.
I did have a lot of questions, and I'm trying to put all those things that we talked about together with what we're talking about right now. But I'm stumbling for words.
Brain loading. Okay, so. Kieran, you were saying at the start of this conversation that the standard model is kind of a relatively complete picture as it is. And in order to account for dark matter, we would have to extend the standard model. So maybe just to like help Benjamin and to help our listeners reframe what that complete picture looks like and what that extension would be, how would you kind of surface level give that explanation?
Yeah, so I think a way to think about it is that the standard model of particle physics is like a, it's a sort of a mathematical contraption. It's like a puzzle box. It's something which has, it's like a puzzle, but it's a multi-dimensional puzzle. It has all these pieces, has all these complicated little jigsaw edges which fit together in a particular way. And the standard model fits together into this sort of beautiful little cube. So in the sense that the standard model is complete, we know the standard model doesn't describe everything, but nor does it attempt to describe everything. It describes most of the things which are relevant for particle physics. Almost everything relevant for particle physics, but the sense in which I mean it's complete is that there's no gaps in it. There's no like room for adding more stuff. It's this sort of self-consistent thing which is enormously mathematically complex. It's very hard to break apart. And also it's very fine-tuned. I mean, there's very few ways of fiddling around with the way these pieces sort of fit together and actually end up with a sort of a puzzle box that actually exists as a sort of a complete thing. In the sense, there's very few alternatives that you could think of to the standard model. It had to be that way to be a mathematically complete theory. So this is the reason why it's sort of a hard area to study, is because the standard model explains so beautifully all of the experiments that we do in particle physics, pretty much, apart from like one or two minor details, which are sort of even then are a little bit debatable. So it can do things like predicting the tools you use in conjunction with the standard model. It can do things like predicting fundamental quantities to like 12 decimal places. I mean, it's just this level of precision which is just completely unheard of in any other area of science. So it's really like one of the best theories or like theoretical frameworks that exists anywhere in science. So that then leads to all sorts of problems when you think that it's this fundamental theory. It's trying to describe things at the most fundamental level, but it doesn't describe everything at the fundamental level. There are some things which it does miss. The sort of famous one is gravity. But in some sense, gravity is a very weird type of force, and it also doesn't really play any role in particle physics. There's essentially no result of any particle physics experiments which really cares about gravity. And there are a few other sort of minor things, like a couple of the numbers it gets wrong at like the 13th decimal place or the 10th decimal place or something like that, which sort of keep people up at night. And then there's things to do with the neutrinos. Neutrinos fits very neatly into the standard model, but they have a few properties which go a little bit beyond what the standard model is sort of able to explain. So the neutrinos are a little bit of an outlier. But I think the most glaring emission of the standard model is dark matter. Because it does appear to have all the properties of matter, so it should have share in some way the properties of the matter that we know already exists, and yet it just doesn't fit in there at all. So you don't. It's not simply like you just have to make a little gap and slot the dark matter in there. You have to really extend the whole mathematical structure into a much wider thing to get a dark matter to get an understandable which also includes dark matter. But I think probably most crucially, this question will be answered experimentally. We could come up with many ideas for how to do that, and indeed there are a huge number of ideas how to do that. It's not like we have no shortage of ideas. We have shortage of experimental results that enable us to test any of these. That's really the issue, and I think that the reason the field is a bit murky and it's sort of. I wouldn't say it's stagnated, but there has not been this sort of radical progress in a very long time on the front of dark matter, and that's just becoming from the fact that dark matter just doesn't seem to want to give any clues at all as to its sort of fundamental nature.
Dark and mysterious, yeah. Intentionally so. Well, I guess, and just as context, one of the things that you said that is taken for granted maybe in particle physics is the reason why gravity doesn't play a role in these calculations is that when you get to such small distances between particles, correct me if I'm wrong, these fundamental particle forces that we don't necessarily have a strong intuitive feeling for because they work on small scales, when you get to those small scales, they are much stronger than gravity would be at those scales. And so that's why gravity doesn't play a role, right?
Yeah, so gravity is just an incredibly weak force, to use the terminology. It's the funny thing about gravity is that it, unlike the other forces, there are only positive or gravitational charges, and there are only attractive gravitational forces, which is a little bit unusual. So you don't form these sort of neutral particles like atoms, out of gravity. When you go to the sort of macroscopic scale, all of the other fundamental forces have sort of gotten bound up into these particles like atoms. So you no longer see them really at these sort of large scales. But gravity is left behind, even though it's a very weak force, it's left behind as the kind of only residual force which exists on the large scales. But because it's so weak, it plays an enormous role on large scales when it's the only force in the game. But on very small scales, it's completely irrelevant compared to the other fundamental forces which govern the way particles kind of talk to each other.
Right. Yeah. Benjamin's making a face for people who are just listening.
I'm happy to be part of the conversation, but I'm also learning too. So there's things happening in my head. particles are so small that gravity is too big to interact with it. Right? Is that a dumb way of saying it?
So it's that gravity is too feeble. Like, you need to build up huge numbers of particles before the force of gravity is actually it has any relevance to the behavior of the object that's feeling the force of gravity. So when you at the particle level, the force of gravity is just completely irrelevant compared to all of the other fundamental forces which it's feeling much more strongly.
Hmm.
Maybe another way of conceptualizing that is Benjamin, if you think about the gravitational force, will be determined by, the product of two masses,
right,
and how far apart they are. And so, when you're talking about these really, really small, very low mass particles, the kind of absolute strength of the force between that interaction is quite small. Whereas if you take those same two particles and you look at the interaction because of other forces that are determined not by their very, very small masses, but by their, charge, their electric charge.
Other properties.
That would be, yeah, exactly. That would be a much larger force overall. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Science be like that.
Science be like that. Okay.
You're kind of like, cool. So
I don't know. It's all super interesting. I'm just trying to see where some of my notes might apply to this things that I didn't expect to be talking about.
what was like the number one question that you had coming into this conversation?
Why are neutrinos called types called flavors?
That's a good question. I don't know who came up with that.
Is it just some kind of idea.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because like in particle physics, when you start to do the sort of zoology of particle physics, and this is the part where things get confusing. When you start to try to categorize all the different types of particles and all of the different properties they can have. So every particle is it's a thing which exists. There are particles of a certain type, but they all have a bunch of properties which are sort of bespoke to them. Like they have a mass. They have this thing called a spin, which you can think of as just like a little arrow that they carry around. They have charges, which is like how strongly they interact with the different forces. And you start to build up all of these different names for things, and you start to just kind of run out of words to describe them. So we have electric charges, which are quite easy. You can either have a positive charge or a negative charge. But then when you go to the strong force, there are like three types of charges. So we use red, blue, and green to describe them. And then we also have this thing where we have all the fundamental particles have like multiple copies of them. So like the up and the down quark come in kind of like a pair, but then there's this extra generation, the charm and the strange, and then another generation on top of that, like the top and the bottom. And you start, it's just sort of the numbers of things which you're having to list starts to get a little bit unwieldy. So like, yeah, we end up using these sort of funny words to sort of try to make sense of all of this. And flavor is the one which is associated with that sort of those multiple generations. Because the thing is that you have the up quark, the down quark, the electron, and one neutrino. That set of four particles, exist as a set, and it has to be that exact set for the standard model to make mathematical sense. The fact that there are three of those sets copied, we have no idea why, and this is like one of the major unsolved problems of the particle physics, because the nature would be we would be perfectly content to live our lives with just the set of those four particles. Everything would work the same. Those other generations, they don't really play any role in our everyday lives, and yet nature created them for some reason. We don't know.
It's almost like Dr. Seuss started naming a few of these things. Because it makes sense.
Yeah.
Some are up, some are down, some are red, some are blue.
A lot of it is a symptom of many of these developments were... So like the latter part of the 20th century, or the sort of mid 20th century to the late 20th century is when the US really took hold of the field, and many of the advancements came from the US. And like Americans just have a slightly different style for naming things than the sort of classically educated men of the past who may have used sort of hoity-toity Latin or Greek and stuff like that. So things like quarks and flavors and red, green, and blue, and up, down, charm, strange, top, bottom. I wouldn't hold Americans responsible entirely for these, but it was just sort of a change in style of how things were named after a while.
Sorry.
So the next generation of particle physicists who are raised on Pokemon might be coming up with particles you have in a water type.
It's way worse now. I mean, I'm sure you were. Astronomy is also pretty bad for this as well, for coming up with names for things.
There's just
too many things to name, and it's more fun to give them fun names than just name them like 1, 2, 3 or alpha, beta, gamma, and so on, right?
That's true. And I guess it makes things a little bit more welcoming and more inclusive when like you're coming from the outside and you see these fun naming conventions. You're like, oh, okay, this is relatable. It's not all like, you know, boring people in lab coats, I should say. Okay, cool.
If we extend the standard model and start, and we have a new category of thing, we start calling them like smells or something like that, then I think maybe we need to rethink exactly what we're doing. Yeah.
I want to switch analogies for smells.
Yeah.
I'd like to have salty particles, sweet particles, umami particles.
Oh, I was going to say umami. Damn it.
Yeah. This is good. Yeah, but
up red spin particle. Good lord. I love it.
But speaking of making these concepts kind of accessible and understandable, it seems like you do a fair bit of outreach. I mean, you know, this podcast aside, like just looking back, if anybody does a quick Google or look at your CV, like you've been doing a lot of outreach for a long time. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why do you find it so important to do outreach?
I would say I find it fun more than important. I think it is important. I think that some scientists are doing outreach to get the message out to feedback the knowledge which ultimately taxpayers are paying for. I think everyone sort of appreciates that's the sort of important side of it. I find it fun, and I find it quite useful for me, because I think that the skills you gain when you try to digest a concept and make it express it in a new way that is better for an audience who doesn't have all of the training in a specific area, doesn't know all of the sort of jargon, doesn't know all of the sort of standard ways of explaining things. I think it does actually help you understand what you're talking about better. At least for me. I mean, I'm somebody who needs to, I need to really think through something and pass it in my own language before I can understand something. I often struggle to, even my own colleagues, I sometimes struggle to understand what they're saying. So I will have to sort of think what they say, repackage it in my own language, and then I can sort of understand it. So that sort of just exercise of just constantly repackaging things in new language to try and express them to different people with different levels of knowledge of the subject, I just find to be extremely useful for me, and also quite fun, and then it just has the added benefit of being a kind of a generally good thing to do anyway, because the public should know about the science that they're paying for. And also they want to, I mean, most of the time I've been fortunate enough to go to do outreach in venues where people actually want to hear what I have to say. So I find it useful, but it's also of course important as you know.
You mentioned earlier, people ask you like, have you found it yet? What other types of, well, what's like one of the more common questions you get from people you know and associate with when they talk about work? Like, what's one of those, when they try to understand what you do, what's the most common question that you get asked?
What's the most common? What would I say? I mean, yeah, I think that it's more common than you would expect to get people who are very skeptical of the whole idea, which is good. I mean, it's good to be skeptical. I think some people, when they talk about particularly the area of dark matter, don't do a good enough job of expressing why we're so convinced of it. So there are definitely a lot of people out there, and maybe even an increasing number of people out there, who are just sort of skeptical of the whole idea and think it's this sort of cult which we've built up just to try and sort of sustain our own jobs. People are a bit nicer about it. When you read YouTube comments, that's the kind of spirit. But in astronomy societies, people will capture it in slightly different ways. Be a bit nicer about it. But yeah, this is kind of becoming more and more common that, you know, the idea of like, what if you've got everything wrong? What if this whole thing is this, is the smoke and mirrors? It's just like you've gone down some path and you're unable to see a way out of it because you're so stuck in this particular idea. And like, you know, I appreciate that point of view, but also like, you have to consider the fact that like dark matter is this incredibly active area of research. Like, it's an incredibly competitive field. There's pretty much guaranteed a Nobel Prize or a few at the end of it for the person who can solve it. So there's a great price on a great sort of reward that will come from thinking differently. So it's not like people don't want to think about the problem differently. We're not just sort of wondering about it just to try and sustain our own jobs. But yeah, so this is the one of these questions which I'm seeing more and more frequently these days.
It's fine.
Nice.
Dark matter skeptics.
Yeah,
I just love that's a contingent of people that exists. Like, what do you hope to gain?
Yeah, it's a brand of the generalized skeptics, that, you know, people who are just skeptical of literally everything that's being done in science these days. But yeah, dark matter is maybe people would argue is a symptom of a larger problem, perhaps.
I mean, I guess these things also have a way of, within their fields, working themselves out. I think that, you know, physicists themselves would not necessarily work on a dead end field for more than, you know, a generation or two before people kind of realize it's not viable. I don't know, maybe Kieran, you've been around a bit longer as an active researcher than I have. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, there were definitely ideas that like showed no promise or that seemed too far away from yielding any kind of results that people sort of moved away from because there's just nothing to do there. Like, it's like there's no, you get no gratification in seeing anything that you're doing experimentally verified. You get, and just at a sort of a basic functional level, you write papers that get no citation. So it's just, there's no longevity in a career, which is just sort of showing no promise. And you can sort of see ideas that are going that way already. Like, there's the idea of supersymmetry, which is one of these ways of extending the standard model. That was like unbelievably popular for many, many years, up until the sort of the switch on of the Large Hadron Collider. And then, but there was this group of physicists who just were pretty convinced that you would switch the Large Hadron Collider and just all of these new particles would just be spilled out instantly, and you would discover all these things overnight. And that just didn't happen, and it just kept on not happening. And now people, it ruled out a lot of these models of supersymmetry that people liked. And it's still completely possible that the standard model is supersymmetric, and there are all these particles out there. They're just at energies that we would not be able to access with the sort of the humble Large Hadron Collider. But that's essentially the essence of the problem, is that like, it's still, you know, maybe it's still a good idea, but it seems like it will show no promise. over the next few years. So you have to, a lot of those people sort of moved on to ideas like dark matter, where there are a bunch of new experiments which are being built and will happen. There are a bunch of extremely large astronomical facilities which will be built and will be used to look for things like dark matter. So it's like, you know, you move to an area where you think there will actually be some kind of development. I mean, it's theorists can't find out what the world is made of on their own. They need experiments. They need observations. So like you have to go with what is actually accessible. A lot of people are you know, saying, okay, we need to be planning for the next big collider now, because this will be like a generational project. It will take like 50 years to build. But that's like that's essentially the career of a single person. So people decide, the worry is like, do I really want to invest my entire life in this project?
Yeah. I mean, Benjamin and I discussed this in the previous episode, even though we were talking about the standard model of particle physics, we spoke about LIGO and you know, like how from Newtonian gravity to general relativity by Einstein to then, you know, Kip Thorne and others in the second half of the last century to, like, you know, in the past decade now actually seeing the results.
Yeah.
It's a long road to get there.
Yeah, well, I mean, all credit to those people, really, because, like, you know, like social gravitational waves is an example of where, you know, a field that to some people it seemed like almost like a joke, or almost like it was basically a completely stagnant, and then all of a sudden, they had whether or not they got lucky is debatable, but they, you know, obviously there was a lot of hard work that went into preparing for an experiment of that particular size. But ultimately there was some element of luck involved, because they needed those black holes to actually merge. And there were still going to be questions about, like, are they going to be merging often enough? Are they going to be merging? And are the gravitational waves going to have the strength that they need to have to be observed? So that's this is an example of a field which suddenly had a complete revolution just thanks to the hard work of some people who just they knew that this thing was had to be possible, so they just kept plugging away at it, and eventually it worked.
Yeah, wow, there you go. We're getting close to the end here. Benjamin, did you have any last questions that you wanted to ask, you know, while we have the expert on the call with us?
No, nothing logical at all left in the woodworks. I'm completely derailed, and this has just been phenomenal to listen to.
It's been great. It's been a lot of fun. Kieran, if folks want to learn more about your research or keep up with you online, where would be the best place for them to find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter, X, whatever. you can find me by googling my name and physics or dark matter. I'm pretty much the only dark matter physicist with my name, and I also have a website where I keep all of my stuff with my research, which is publicly available.
Fantastic. Awesome. And as per usual, Benjamin, where can the good people find you on the interwebs?
Just go to all the social media platforms and search for Science Actually. Facebook's the big one, but you can see everything on, just name them, Twitter,
just all of them,
TikTok, whatever, LinkedIn, it's there.
It's all there, it's all readily available. If you want to see previous episodes, and I mean see previous episodes, you can check out our YouTube page or TikTok, as Benjamin mentioned. You can find me at Fun Fact Science on all the good social media platforms, as well as all the bad ones. Kieran, thank you again so much for joining us.
No worries.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
I've enjoyed watching your videos on YouTube, and I'm going to keep watching more until I fully understand every word.
All right, folks, and we will see you all next time on Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Listen to this. Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough,
just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. Thank you. that's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned, a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. Keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
She feels so sort of insignificant, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Can we have your liver then?
Yeah, all right, you talked me into it.
Eric!